welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. May all your Thanksgiving travels go well. We are recording this on Tuesday for your enjoyment on Wednesday, and of course throughout the Thanksgiving holiday, but just keep in mind, should something big happen Tuesday night, we didn't see it, but you did. Joining us in Boston, but soon on our way to Cleveland, because why wouldn't you go to Cleveland right before Thanksgiving, Jackie McMullen? Sounds great.
Pray for me, everyone.
I love it.
Pray for me. There's a big storm in the Midwest and a windstorm here. Everybody pray for me, please.
I'm going to say something. You can say a lot of bad stuff about my hometown. My hometown's Akron, but I count Cleveland. I'm not like LeBron. I count Cleveland. We know how to take care of snow at the airport.
I don't know how to take care of a lot of things.
But we do know how to take care of snow at the airport.
Unfortunately, that's your best pitch for tourism there is we know how to take care of snow.
You know what? I have no beef with Cleveland. All those years we were in the finals there, no beef at all. Great restaurants, friendly people. The hotels maybe could use a little uplift. But beyond that, I was very comfortable in Cleveland. A good workout. I need very few things, like a good workout place in the gym, a good place to have a nice meal. Very simple. That's all.
And a man who doesn't know how to drive in the snow is Ben McMahon. You're banned from the from the roads when the snow's down. I don't trust you Texans. McMahon, where are you headed? I know you're traveling today too.
No. I'm right here at home. I've got Mavs Clippers tonight. The people have already seen Luka versus Kawhi and Paul George, but that's where I'm heading tonight.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about Luka here in a minute. But first, guys, I really want to talk about what Zach Lowe and Adrian Wojnarowski reported over the weekend, which was potential radical changes to the NBA schedule. Now, in my mind, the devil is in the details here. And nothing is firm. Nothing is established. I am definitely in the belief that things need to – that the NBA needs a little bit of a makeover to their schedule. However – I do not think that this particular proposal is going to fly. I don't want to get into the real nitty-gritty of it, but Jackie, I'll start with you. What was your reaction to when you – I mean, some of this has been talked about and rumored for a while.
Sure, for quite a bit.
The reason it's coming now is they need to vote on this by April because they want to do this in the 75th anniversary season, which is 21-22, which, by the way, is just a cover – for why they're doing it. That way, if it fails and they can abandon it, they can say, oh, we were just doing this for the 75th anniversary season. It's kind of a little specious. But that's why it's coming up now. Jackie, what was your reaction to it?
Well, I think the idea of reseeding as the playoffs go on is a great one. I've always thought that. If it turns out, and I'm not saying it's going to be true because I'm very bullish on Milwaukee still and the Sixers, but let's just say for argument's sake that the Lakers and the Clippers are the two best teams. They should have the right to play each other in the finals, so I'm all on board with that. And I don't think that's so difficult, Brian, to do. The play-in tournament at the end of the year, of course, that's to discourage tanking, I guess, and to keep all the teams engaged throughout the end of the NBA season and make them feel like they have something to play for down the road. So I think the biggest problem when I look at this is the idea of this mid-season tournament or whatever we call. So that to me is a little problematic. I don't see how you pull that off. Now, I know it's modeled after European soccer and to some extent the European basketball tournaments they have, but I think it's just going to take everybody a little while to be able to process that, especially the fans that have to pay money to go watch it.
Yeah, I'm with you, Jackie. I get the play-in tournament, all that other stuff. That mid-season tournament, I have two questions. Why would fans give a crap, and why would teams give a crap? And, you know, Zach Lowe had some stuff about ideas to potentially, you know, add some incentives outside of bonuses or whatever, but I just have a hard time picturing that mid-season tournament being something that's more than a novelty.
So, Jackie is right. It's based off of European soccer. Now, let me just make and if you're a European soccer fan, you're going to think this is pretty basic, but if you don't understand it, just let me explain it real quick. So, when you're playing, you know, let's just take a team in the Premier League in England, for example. You could potentially be involved in three or four different competitions at once. You're playing in your country league, okay, where you're playing all the teams in your country. You're playing in a continental league across Europe, which is the Champions League, which is pretty much the premium thing, and that is more like a playoffs scenario. You're playing in something called the FA Cup, which, you know, various countries have other cups that they play for. I think in England you can win up to 5 trophies in a year. And that's what Adam Silver is trying to do here. He's trying to incentivize things that you can win and hang a banner for other than your championship, and therefore, on a business standpoint, sell. So that if your team is out of it, making the playoffs, for example, it may still be in it, winning some other trophy. But there is a humongous difference that I don't think people are, that I don't even think that the league is paying attention to. And that is that in European sports, this happens in basketball too, they don't, like in soccer, they don't have playoffs. The season ends when the season ends and you are the champion with your number of points and that's it. So those mid-season, those concurrent tournaments that go on for various cups sort of serve as their playoffs. The big difference about the NBA is, of course, they have a playoff, so that's the culmination of the season. And so that's where I think that the disconnect is not going to work, 1-2. The other thing is, as Zach and Woj have reported, this tournament would happen in November and December. And I know that they feel like that, you know, most teams play hard at the beginning of the season. You don't have anybody tanking yet. And that's a reason to do it at the beginning of the season. They also feel that there's a football lull after the completion of the regular season of college football, that they feel like there's a lull in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. I happen to disagree. I think that football still is king throughout till the new year, and I think that it will be overlooked, as McMahon said. As for the play-in tournament, so I think the midseason tournament is DOA. I think they'll do it. They'll probably do it, and nobody will care, and it'll be DOA.
And it'll be a dud, yeah.
The play-in tournament, I think, is genius because this has a different inspiration. The inspiration for the play-in tournament, for me, is college basketball conference tournaments. That you have a fighter's chance to make it all the way to the end. Now, I think that the proposal that they have put forward, which could change, these are all just sketches. Right now the proposal is that only the teams that would make the tournament would make the play-in tournament would be seeds 7 through 10. And those four teams would play off for seeds 7 and 8. I think that's a mistake. I have advocated for this for more than a decade, mostly on deaf ears. I did not come up with the proposal. The proposal was come up with by Mark Workenteam, who he probably stole from somebody else, but Mark Workenteam brought it to me in the mid-2000s, which his proposal was called Make Every Game Count. And what it was is the eighth seed, 1 through 7 would be established as normal, then the other remaining 8 teams, there's 15 teams in each conference, so 7 get in, then the 8 teams play a 3-game single elimination tournament, just like a conference tournament in the American East Conference. Just like a team that's at the bottom of the SEC could get hot and run their way through and win enough games and qualify for the playoffs. Think about how fascinating that would be this year with the Golden State Warriors. Think about how the Warriors could be the 13th or 14th seed in the West, or maybe the 15th seed in the West, and they get Curry back, and they bring Klay back, and all of a sudden they could win their way in. And then that's what makes the NCAA, that's what makes March Madness so great. That, I think, the American fan and the basketball fan will embrace. This midseason tournament, I'm sorry for the filibuster, McMahon.
I like that idea. If the lottery odds are put in place before the play-in tournament.
That would have to be worked out for sure.
I do think you have to figure it out, but that would be interesting.
Because the issue we have now, Jackie, is that we get into March and teams are, even if they're not specifically tanking, they don't care about those games. We have a whole bunch of games where they are meaningless. This would at least make the difference between getting the 15 seed and the 11 seed somewhat meaningful.
Right. I just want to make sure I understand your premise, though. So then let's just say, for argument's sake, based on your scenario you just gave us, that Golden State does exactly what you say. As the 14th team, they manage to play their way in to be the number 8 seed. But then we're back to the regular best of 7, yes?
Yes, best of 7. Yeah. And, you know, as far as the reseeding during the...
I do vote for best of 5 in the first round, but that's neither here nor there.
I do too. I loved it back in the day. I covered those series and they were incredible because, you know, the thing about basketball that I still say, especially the way the game is played now, I can't stress this enough, because there's such a reliant on the 3-point shot and we all know why. We don't need to review that again. But when a team goes cold and you can't put the ball in the basket, and it happens every night all across the league, teams get vulnerable simply because They go cold. And so the idea of a best of 5 when a team goes cold that costs them a key game, I love that idea. I really do.
Well,
because I'm still, you know, all these years later, guys, as much as I like the 3-point shot, I'm in mourning for the post-up players of my generation, maybe because I was once a post-up player myself, and I want there to be a price if you play that way and for some reason it falters. I want there to be a price, and right now there isn't.
Yeah. Well, there sure was for the Rockets in Game 7 of the 18 West Finals, 0-27.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Well, when you get into eliminating games, you get into revenue issues. I will say this: if you right now, for better or worse, and I do not need the sports scientists on here, I acknowledge the season is too long, but for better or worse, the message that is being sent to the fan, regardless of how you get there, okay, is that the regular season doesn't matter. And if you continue to enforce that to your fans, they will believe you. And they will, and they're already starting to do that.
There's plenty of them already to do, Brian. There are plenty
of
them already to do.
So my thing is here, that is, before you get into the nitty gritty of whose plan goes this way or whose plan goes that way, that is the big problem. That is the problem that needs to be addressed. And it probably needs to be addressed radically and not by a midseason tournament. The real thing that has to be done, and we can deny, and I was a denier of this for a long time, not on science grounds, but more on revenue grounds, was this season needs to be taken down in terms of games. There needs to be more of a scarcity, and so that those individual games matter more. When you take the volume down, each game matters more, and there will be more interest in those games. That is the only way I think this is going to work, and it's all going to just be a dance till that reality comes. That reality could come in 5 years, it could come in 10. I'd prefer it comes in 2, but it won't.
Well, and Brian, you forgot one really critical point, I think. I think if you're the NBA right now and you're watching how Kawhi Leonard is managing his career with the Clippers, with the rest or the injury, we can debate that again all day too, but you can help eliminate those rest days if you reduce the schedule further and give, you know, maybe eliminate back-to-back games. I don't know if you can eliminate them completely. I think that would be very difficult to do. But eliminate these pockets of games where every coach looks at it and says, that's a rest day, that's a rest day, that's a rest day.
At the end of the day, the NBA is still a league based on volume. I've talked about this many times. I'll just say it again. The NBA game an NBA game very much mirrors the season. Most of the time, the first three quarters are perfunctory, and the fourth quarter, you play hard. In an NBA arena, the first three quarters are where the money is made. You talk to people, they say that there are no, you know, once you start the fourth quarter, they cut off beer sales. There's no more money being made. It's all costs after that. The NBA season takes place to pay all the bills. And then the reason it's that long is to pay all the bills. And so that's the issue. The NBA is a volume league, you know, by and large. People say, well, why is it a best, you know, like you said, McMahon and Jackie, best of 5. Why is it best of 7? The reason it's best of 7 is because they can't get away with best of 9. Because at the end of the day, it's about volume.
Because they make a lot of money on those playoff games. Right.
I can tell you, some of those best of five series were just electric. They were electric. It was really fun.
And some of the best of seven first round series, you're like, okay, it's 3-0. It hadn't been competitive. Let's just get game four.
Even if it's not 3-0, the gentleman's sweep is very rarely exciting.
Right.
You know, all right. Well, that's what we said. We'll talk more about that as it goes along. I just, you know, there's a lot of people talking about that right now. Hey, if you're looking for some more information about potential major in-season NBA changes coming up, go listen to the two guys that broke the story on the Woj Pod. Adrian Wojnarowski and Zach Lowe dive deep into the proposals. They know all the ins and outs of the stuff like that, the specifics. And also, Woj, of course, has talked to the whole league, to every executive, and he knows what their concerns are. And so you can get complete analysis of all that on the Woj Pod. And, of course, you can download it wherever you get your podcast, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. McMahon, I think we've got to talk about maybe the most fascinating thing that's happening in the NBA right now. And that is a 20-year-old. Is he 20?
He's 20. He does not turn 21 until February. The Mavericks crashed in the Western Conference party, and the face of the franchise can't even legally buy a beer yet. This kid went for 41, 6 rebounds, 10 assists on the road while kicking the Rockets are a West contender's butt. And it was maybe his third or fourth most impressive game of last week. It's ridiculous what kind of role this kid's on.
I'm just going to give you the basic raw numbers here because I didn't realize how amazing these were. 31 points a game, 10.1 rebounds, 9.8 assists. We're talking about 16 games here. It's not the whole thing.
You forgot one important number, if I may. Excuse me.
Yes.
You forgot one important number. He's averaging about 32 minutes a game. That's the most important number of all. He's doing this
33.
It's fluctuating between 32 and 33 minutes a game. That, to me, is the most significant number of all.
Well, and they're able to get it down to that because they kicked the Warriors' butts and the Cavs' butts so badly that he got to sit the last 15 or so minutes of those games, still got a 35-point triple-double in one game, and in the other game had, 30-some-odd, 14 assists, 7. I mean, it's insane. And the Mavericks right now, two things. Obviously, it's early, and they have played a soft schedule. Which, by the way, somehow they lost to the Knicks twice, but that's neither here nor there. They've played a soft schedule. The Mavericks right now, based on offensive rating, points per 100 possessions, have the best offense in NBA history. So not only is the kid putting up crazy numbers, but he's doing it in such a way that, the whole team's rolling. And Porzingis is starting to really come on. Tim Hardaway Jr. has been a great fit since he's gotten into the starting lineup. Luka is putting up crazy numbers and making everybody around him better at 20.
I'm sorry, I need to just jump in here for a moment. You guys are talking about Luka Doncic. Just so everyone's aware, this was like a 5-minute run-up without actually mentioning his name. So for all the listeners,
well, that's
Luka
so
Doncic.
Funny.
Well, we trust our listeners when we say the 20-year-old who plays for the Mavericks. And we also said earlier we were going to talk about Luka. But thank you, Andrew. I appreciate you doing your
Thanks,
job
Hammer.
And keeping us on balance.
That's actually really funny.
That's an editor right there. That's an editor.
Yeah, there it is.
By the way, he's shooting 62% on 2-point shots. For a guard, and who's not 6'8"? Well, I guess he is.
He is 6'8". Yeah, he is.
All right, never mind. It's 62% for a second-year player.
Here's the thing: for a guy who he's only dunked the ball 3 times this year, he is obviously not an explosive athlete. He was not blessed with LeBron-esque athleticism. He's not, this Greek freak or whatever, whatever kind of Slovenian freak in terms of athleticism. He's elite finishing around the basket. His floater game is ridiculous. The three is, you know, it's hot and cold, but when he's hitting his three-pointer, especially when it's a step back, like, you can't guard the guy. And so he's putting up these numbers with ridiculous efficiency. He's the usage rate and efficiency that he's
putting up right now.
He
turns the ball over a little bit too much, but
okay.
Again,
I was going to say, he's Harden-esque in that sense.
Yeah.
I looked it up. Harden is the only guy in NBA history who's had a usage rate at 35-plus. And a true shooting percentage, I think it was over 60%. And Harden did that each of the last two seasons. He's doing it again this year. So is the Greek Freak. And then Luka just dipped under 35% usage rate, but his true shooting percentage is way over. So
right.
It's crazy that we've got three guys right now just putting up historic, not just points per game, but efficiency. And one of them is 20 years old.
Well, and his feel, when I watch him, I don't even care about the numbers so much. It's just watching him. The great players know what's happening before their teammates do, and sometimes their coaches. And he's one step ahead. And that's a gift that I don't think you can mm-hmm. teach. And that's what I see. When I watch him play, he reminds me a little bit of Bird that way, in that he's anticipating the next pass, the next play, before it even happens. And that's what great players do.
Jackie, I was going to ask you about the Bird comparison, actually, because, as you know, Rick Carlisle played with Bird, coached under Bird, right. Is really good friends with Bird, and Rick is always mm-hmm. telling Luka Bird stories. And Bird is one of the three guys that Rick will bring up when he's, you know, he always says he's the first Luka Doncic, but he will say, you know, there are shades of Bird, there are shades of Magic, and Jason Kidd's the other guy that he brings up. How much Bird do you see in Luka?
Well, what I just referenced is the thing that jumps out at me. This idea of being able to watch the game unfold ahead of everybody else. You know when you go to like a, I don't know if you guys do this ever, once in a while, just for the heck of it, I'll go way up to the top of the garden to like the ninth floor to watch the game from above. Because you can watch things happening. They unfold in front of you when you're up at that vantage point. Luka and Bird, they don't need to do that. They mm-hmm. can see it.
They live there.
Right. I think, you know, Bird was a better 3-point shooter for sure. But Luka's, man, his passing, he reminds me so much of Bird. He really, really does. He's just, I mean, I that's a big comparison to make, you know, and so I think Luka has his own qualities that are different from Bird, but the main thing I think about is just that anticipation. And that's a really great skill. And the one thing, too, that I like about Luka, and I don't think we've seen it in its full glory yet, because I think Rick probably told him to tone it down a little bit last year, is the trash talking and the just positive self-talk and the belief every single minute of every second he's on the floor that he's the best. And that's also what all the great ones have.
McMahon, so what is the Mavericks' season outlook at this point? I mean, they look like a playoff team, for sure.
Right. It's funny because... So they've won five in a row now. You know, they like I said, they had the
heading into this game tonight that we don't we don't know what's going to happen. But
heading into the Clippers game, and so you know, but there was some okay again. The schedule's been a little soft. You know, they caught the Raptors obviously, and the Raptors had a bunch of injuries. The Spurs are struggling. I mean, you know, you can talk about recent championships with the Warriors and Cavs, but you know what's on the floor there. But they were dominant against those teams. And then it's like, okay, hey, here comes the test. Rockets and Clippers. So the Rockets were the first real test there. And they kicked their butts. The Rockets never led that game. I mean, they pulled within five and the Mavericks, you know, smoked them again. They were up by as many as 22. It was just Luka put on a show for a European primetime audience. Porzingis was dominant. You know, and stretches at the defensive end. I mean, they just really look like this significantly better team. And so I go in there and I'm asking, hey, you go into the season, you know, playoffs is the big goal. Are you thinking bigger? And Luka, Porzingis, Carlisle, they're all kind of on the same page. Hey, we haven't done anything yet. Let's just get in the playoffs. But then you kind of whisper to people around, around the fringes. And they're like, yeah, F waiting. We can win big now. Like, we need to, we've got an opportunity with a top five player in the league, you know, and Porzingis, they believe, will be back into all-star form if he's not already, you know, relatively quickly. I definitely think the Mavericks are looking at this. It's gone from, hey, it would be a nice big step to make the playoffs, to why can't we do some damage this season?
The one pushback for you, Tim, and you know this already, go look at their defensive rating. You know, 18th in the league. Defense efficiency,
yeah,
18th in the league.
I'm going to tell you
this,
though.
If they're going to go places, Tim, they got to play better defense.
And I'm going to tell you this. I agree with you. And at the same time, obviously that rating takes into effect the whole season. Porzingis for the first, you know, X amount of games, I don't know what the exact number is, wasn't, you know. Porzingis recently, he looks like a dominant defensive player. And I think to his credit, he's kind of accepting that he's going to be the sidekick offensively. Rick is working to make sure he's involved in that end. But Porzingis is really putting his emphasis into, I'm going to be a dominant defender and I'm going to rebound. And, I mean, he's been a force on that end lately.
So let me ask you this. Could they be an Iguodala trade team?
Yeah. They expressed interest in Iguodala over the summer. They certainly had conversations.
So they have
Courtney Lee as an expiring contract.
They have Courtney Lee. Now, I don't know what the price of Iguodala would be. Not that you would give a first-round pick, but just in general, the Mavericks aren't really able to trade.
Well, they can't do that anyway.
They can't trade any first because they're encumbered by what they owe the Knicks for Porzingis. They do have a second-round pick this year and then some future seconds. I mean, I don't know what the Grizzlies – I know that the Grizzlies would prefer to trade him than buy him out, even if it's just a single second-round pick. Now,
I just went to Memphis, and they are absolutely adamant, will not buy out Iguodala.
I agree.
They say they are trading him, period.
They have told me the same thing, but let me just say that that's what I would say, too, before February 8th
right.
or whatever the trade deadline
yeah.
is.
Right.
Right. Revisit if they haven't traded him by the deadline.
It would take – I don't think that it would work straight up. I think they would have to add a little something else to the trade to do for Courtney Lee. But even if they got a second-round pick for the question is renting Iguodala – of course, you would get his rights and you could retain him if he wanted to stay. But is renting Iguodala worth that type of maneuver? For some teams – it may not be worth it because, you know, the big challenge of trading for Iguodala. Also, you don't know where he's at. I mean, you hope that he comes back and is able to be really productive.
Yeah, it's been a while since he's played. You know?
Yeah, but
it's been a while.
But it so for some teams,
I
like, to get to the 17
for a guy at his age, though. Like, you know, probably don't need to worry about having wear of a regular season on him.
Yeah, but how long can he be off before there's diminishing returns?
If you get him by the
February's
trade deadline,
a long
you
time.
Get a. Yeah, then you get 2 months for him to tune up and get into playoff form is the way I would look at that.
Okay.
Well, so I'm just keep an eye on Dallas and Iguodala as a possibility. I haven't heard anything, by the way. I'm not saying that I'm not saying.
Well, again,
that I heard
they were absolutely interested this summer. The Mavericks, the Rockets, and then obviously the two LA teams. I think for a while the Clippers assumed that he would get bought out and he'd end up there. But again, the Grizzlies are they've got their heels dug in.
Right, and I mean the Lakers would love to. The Lakers would love to try to get him too. But the big important thing to realize is because Iguodala makes $17 million, you have to have something to trade to Memphis, and it can't be a guy on a 3-year contract that Memphis doesn't want to hold. And that's why the Mavericks move in here, because they have Courtney Lee, who makes I think $12 or $13 million.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
Okay, we're going to talk real quick about Tissot watches. I don't even know why I have to say it, because if you listen to this podcast, you already know. In fact, if you listen to any ESPN podcast, you already know. But in case you don't, Tissot is a Swiss watch brand, okay? That means it's high quality. And unlike some of the other Swiss watch brands, you can actually get a high quality watch from Tissot at an attractive price. And of course, they're stylish, trendy, innovative, and will look good on your wrist, because that's how they're in business. They bring performance and style to the game by offering painstakingly accurate timekeeping and stylish and authentic watches. And of course, Tissot is a big time supporter of the NBA, so for that reason alone is why you should be interested in them. Each one of Tissot's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. Tissot prides itself on the precision of its style, in its classic sport, and even its contemporary collections, while committing to make excellence accessible to everyone. It's not going to cost you 15 grand, okay? Even though it may look like 15 grand. Great variety from touch watches to sport to classic, and then, of course, they're all trending. As I mentioned, Tissot is the official watch of the NBA, and you can shop their latest timepieces at us.tissotshop.com and, of course, the jewelry stores nationwide. If you want to follow them on Twitter, you can take a look at hashtag ThisIsYourTime or go to Tissot.us on Facebook and Instagram for more information about Tissot. Among the guys having spectacular starts to the season, we take it for granted, but LeBron James.
I thought you were going to say Giannis.
Well, we'll say Giannis.
Who takes LeBron James for granted? Come on now.
I'm not. I'm going to tell you something. I'm not seeing a lot of people talking about how great LeBron's playing.
Oh my god! Well, that's all I hear. And by the way, he deserves every spot of it.
There's four guys who are way ahead of the pack to me in the MVP, early MVP, obviously a month in MVP. The fact that Luka's joined that pack is crazy, but it's LeBron, Giannis, and James Harden, who all he's doing is averaging 38 per game.
And by the way, if you're looking for a good fifth place finisher, don't sleep on Pascal Siakam, who's doing incredible things for a team that's decimated by injuries and still wins.
All right, so our LeBron leading the league in assists, which would be an incredible thing to do in your 17th season. Our last night, which was Monday, but for our fine folks who are traveling on Thanksgiving, it will be a couple days old. Giannis put up 50. In a win over who they play last night?
The Jazz without Gobert.
Jazz.
That's right. Yeah, what's Gobert's injury, by the way?
He's got it's not a serious thing. He's got a left ankle sprain. He's been game time the last couple games, just wasn't able to go. But, you know, no Gobert, no Ed Davis, no chance in hell against Giannis. I mean, 50. You better have some rim protection if you're going to be dealing with Giannis. And he just absolutely ate him up.
So Giannis is averaging 31 a game, which last year when he won the MVP, he averaged 28. So also, Milwaukee just racking up wins without Chris Middleton, mm-hmm. who's an all-star. They're just going slowly.
Like the Lakers, they're in the top five of defensive and offensive ratings. It's like the oldest story in the world. And the Bucks are both in they're in the top five of both. They play both
A couple of things about Giannis, though, just to keep an eye on. He is handling the ball more than he has in the past because they lost Brogdon. So he's averaging a career high in assists. He's averaging 6.5 assists a game. His rebounding is crazy. He's averaging 14 boards.
That's amazing.
He's making twice as many three-pointers per game than he did a year ago. He averaged 0.7 a year ago, so less than one a game. He's averaging 1.5 a game. Most importantly, shooting 5 a game. Percentage is still 30%, not great.
Yeah,
but
still not a high percentage. Yeah.
But here's
the
only thing.
Look at his free throw shooting, Brian.
There you go.
Look at his free throw,
Jackie, that's the one I'm like, what's going on there? So he is.
Yeah.
He is getting to the line 12 times a game, which is just devastating for the opponent. When he is on the attack like that, he's drawing 6 shooting fouls a game. Like, no wonder he's averaging 4 more points a game. But Jackie, as Jackie just mentioned, he has had, now granted, we're talking 17 games, so it's not the season, but it's significant at this point. He's had a precipitous drop off in his free throw shooting. He's shooting 60% from the line, down from 73 a year ago. 2 years ago, 76, which is right about league average. 60% from the line.
I'm actually looking at it. Despite the fact he's going to the line a little bit more than twice, you know, 2 free throws more per game, he's only averaging 0.1 point more per game than last year. Last year he made 6.9 per game. This year it's 7.0. But still, I mean, the guy Kurt Goldsberry tweeted out the little shot chart thing where who's leading the league in points from each area on the floor. Of course it's Giannis at the rim. I mean, it is ridiculous just how easily he gets to the rim. And then once he's in that range, like, you know, 6'11", long arms, great athlete. I mean, he just dunks everything. He also, I saw last night, He's the first guy since Bill Walton in, I think, 76, 77 to have a double-double in the first 17 games of the season. And most of his aren't close. Like last night, 50 and 14. The 14's average.
I mean, I think he's, I thought I read this, that he's on pace to have the highest player efficiency rating ever.
No, that's Luka.
I don't know. I think
maybe they both are.
Right,
they might both.
Maybe they both are. Yeah, they're both probably neck and neck. The thing about Giannis, because I've watched him a lot, I watch them a lot. The thing that strikes me is he's always been, I think, a better passer than we give him credit for. But now he's a better, and I think there's a difference. He's a better playmaker now than he was last year. Do you guys understand that? I think there's a difference, and that's what I see with him. This is what he and Bud talked about.
What you mean
the
whole off-season. Is It's not just the ability to make the pass once it's there, but it's the ability to create the opportunity to make the pass.
Right. Right. And that was one thing that Bud challenged him to do. And what's the word I'm looking? Not very tangible. That's an intangible, right? That's not something you can really practice in a gym by yourself. And that's just the growth of a young player whose ceiling we haven't even come close to seeing yet. So
I was going to just quickly apologize to you. Giannis has dipped in front of Luka on the PER chart.
Jackie's on the ball.
Giannis, I'm looking at Basketball Reference right now. Giannis is at 33.34. Luka, 33.26. The best
Look
for a
that.
Full season in NBA history.
Yeah.
62-63.
Yeah.
Wilt Chamberlain, 31.82.
Yeah. And there's only been maybe three. Wow. There's only been a handful of guys who've ever gone over 30. I think Russell was only 30.
More than a handful. There's been 24 full seasons over 30.
Okay.
But it's still
but how many
like,
guys?
Both,
that, how
they're
many
both
guys
well over the best in NBA. And let's see. Well, yeah. Not,
all right. Don't worry about it.
It's
too far in the weeds.
It's the big names. But Giannis did it last year.
Yeah, and I do think we need to put a little tag on here and remind people that the game was played differently back in the day. No three-point shot, more of a low post presence, which is both good and bad. Like the true everybody talks about true shooting percentage, which I like and I get. But go look at who the leaders are in all true shooting percentage. They're all big men. So all these numbers, you have to be careful before we go too crazy over them. You know, I don't think we're going to argue that Wilt Chamberlain wasn't one of the greatest players in all overall player efficiency rating, no matter what the number says, right? We agree?
Right. And it, like you said, it's a league
that's
built
these
for
guys are
ridiculous offense.
Yeah.
But it's a game that has become, you know, built for offense. But also, like, dude, you don't think Giannis would have been ridiculous in 62-63? I mean, you got
Bill Russell would have
athletes.
Had a problem coming with him coming at him. Bill Russell would have had problems handling that.
You've got unbelievable, like,
I think so.
The skill and athleticism in the league is also the best it's ever been. I think that's safe to say.
Of course. There's plenty of things that are bigger, stronger, faster, all that.
A minute ago, Jackie mentioned how one of the key things to look at is if you got a top 10 offense and a top 10 defense, you're going to be a good team. And if you're top 5 in both, you're going to be great. Guess who's got a top 10 top 8 offense and a top 6 defense? 8 offense, number 6 on defense.
Very easy. Very
how
easy. Your Toronto Raptors.
The defending champion Toronto Raptors. Mm-hmm. Just ho-hum. Beat the Sixers Tuesday night or Monday night without Ibaka and Lowry. Now, they were at home. Embiid went 0 of 11. Did not score.
Ofer.
Gasol had a little bit to do with that 0 of 11, too.
Ofer.
That's true. Well, it's Gasol's incredible. A big reason why. Gasol's shooting 31% this year. Like, his offensive output
I was going to say,
like,
who cares? Don't you almost
right,
want to say
defense,
who cares?
Well, clearly,
know,
they,
right?
they keep winning. They're 12-4. Yeah. They've already gone out west. Kyle Lowry has played 8 games because he's had the broken thumb or the thumb issue. Mm-hmm. If it was broken or as a ligament. And then Serge got hurt the same night. Serge hasn't played. Let me see how many games Serge has played. Serge hasn't played many more games. Serge has played 8 games. They both played 8. And not that, you know, Patrick McCaw, you know, they've got 6 guys on their injury report. It's not like, I don't want to say like Patrick McCaw is or Stanley Johnson have been that important, but still guys they don't have. He only played 8 guys last night. He's at the beginning of the season, Nick Nurse was was trashing Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, saying that he wasn't bringing it. He's only played him in 9 games. He benched him for the start of the season. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's Rondae just rising up. Maybe it's Nick's goading of him. Maybe it's just him getting more comfortable in a new place. But all of a sudden, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson is producing, like, terrific off-the-bench minutes for them. I think he had 16 and 11 against the Sixers. And they got this guy out of Summer League. This was an amazing story, this guy Terrence Davis, who had a great game against the Sixers as well. This guy played one game with the Denver Nuggets Summer League team. The Raptors saw him, swooped in, and, like, signed him in the hallway after the game. And he's contributing for them. And I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about RHJ and Terrence Davis. This is really about Siakam and Fred VanVleet, sure, as Jackie said. Yeah. But Jackie, I mean, come on. Let's give Nick Nurse and the Raptors some credit here. I mean, it's not just that they lost Kawhi. They're, two of their probably 4 best players are dinged up, and they're still doing this.
And never mind that. Just look. They're the slayers of all the kings. I mean, look what they just did to Embiid. Go back and look what they did to Kawhi Leonard. Now, I know they didn't win the game, but has anybody defended Kawhi Leonard better as collectively as a team? That's what sticks out to me with what Nick and his staff is doing. And the players, of course, because they're the ones that are out there on the court. And you mentioned Gasol, Siakam. I mean, these guys, what they're doing to some of the best players in the game, it is just, to me, it's incredible. Incredible. Because they're down. They've been down guys all along. Now, OG has been, I said to Nick when I saw him, I don't know, early in the year, October, I said OG to them was like their free agent signing because, of course, he didn't play at all last year. And we all
knew
he
didn't play in the playoffs. He played during the regular season. But he didn't play in the playoffs.
But he didn't play much during the regular season. I can look it up for you. He didn't play a lot of games. I mean, he was not part of the regular rotation when it mattered, And so he's really been important to them. And I just think what they've done in the face of everybody saying, well, they're cooked, don't be so sure.
I think a lot of people looked at the Raptors going into this and said, well, hey, the Raptors, this could be kind of a reset season. Will they shop some of their vets, come around the trade deadline?
Yeah, for
clearly,
sure. That's
clearly, what everybody's they're talking about. At the minimum, they're Eastern Conference contenders. And like you said, Jackie, Nick Nurse can coach. I mean, we saw that during the playoffs last year, obviously. He was my preseason coach of the year. I'm feeling pretty good about that one. And then their young franchise centerpiece type guys that they developed that, it's not like Siakam was a lottery pick. It's not like VanVleet was a draft pick. But these guys, they developed into franchise centerpiece type of players. And these dudes, after being major contributors to a championship team last year, have taken massive leaps. I mean, Siakam was the most improved player last year, and I think you can argue he's improved more going into this season than he did last season.
Siakam may be one of the greatest development stories in NBA history.
And they feel like he still has, like he's not near his ceiling yet.
Right. You were talking
a lot of
about
a lot of room to grow.
And you were talking about all the Doncic numbers, which are just incredibly impressive. But Siakam's got 20 plus points in 11 of 16 games. He's gone 30 or over 6 times. His usage percentage rate, by the way, for that team is 28.8%.
Plus, he can defend four positions.
I was going to say he's a spectacular defender. I mean, last night, the defensive play of the game was Siakam stealing that pass where he was able to, on a fast 2-on-1 fast break, Ben Simmons to Tobias Harris, he's able to, force Simmons to make the pass and then get back and steal a lob pass. Now, a little bit lower, whatever, but ridiculous play.
Absolutely.
And this guy, his rookie year, he started some games, but it was like he would play the first 8 minutes of each half and they would never let him touch the ball.
Well, and there was reasons for that, believe me. I was there watching him try to shoot.
He's one of the great development stories in the history of the NBA.
He has the best motor in the NBA, the best. I mean, Montrezl Harrell may disagree with me, and he's a big, strong man, and I'm a little afraid
too
of him. Yeah, maybe. But I'd put Siakam's motor up against anybody, and that's why the Raptors decide to draft him, because you can't. It's another thing you can't teach, that motor.
And so I mentioned
the scoring averages, though. 4.2.
7.3 second season, 16.9 last year when he's most improved, 25.7 this year. He's gone from really good contributor to a title team to bona fide superstar.
Here's the other thing. Early in the season, he fouled out of a couple of games and was in deep foul trouble in a couple more. And Nick Nurse, one thing I've noticed about Nurse, we talked about this on the pod before, he's not afraid to challenge his players publicly, and he certainly does it privately.
Mm-hmm.
He basically said, Pascal, stop committing stupid fouls. And he has. You see, how comes, like, now all of a sudden he's able to get his minutes up and his production up because he hasn't been committing as many stupid fouls. And, you know, again, Nick Nurse, here's all you need to know about Nick Nurse. After games and before games, he wears a hat that has his double initials on it, NN. He is not afraid of anything. He is not afraid of anything. I can't believe people aren't walking around Toronto with these hats. That he has two lowercase n's. He wears it with pride.
Well, unfortunately for him,
there's a story behind that hat. I forget what it is now.
He's got somebody sent them to him, and he offered me one of them.
I think Nike sent
them. No, I can't. I said I can't wear those, Nick.
I'm not wearing Nick Nurse gear. But no, the challenge is they've all, like, every player on that team's got their own little logo. Like, are you going to buy Nick Nurse stuff over the Pascal Siakam logo or over the Van Vliet logo? They've all, yeah, like,
Fred's been great. Fred's been great too.
Somebody did a story,
and you know, Marc Gasol
during the playoffs.
Marc Gasol too. I'm telling you, Marc Gasol, what a perfect fit, because, you know, last year documented during the finals his spots. You know, his tête-à-têtes with coaches. I would never call him a problem or anything like that, but he's a guy that speaks his mind, that has very strong ideas about how the game should play. We know that he and Fizdale went up against it. You know, Dave Yeager, and he had moments. And Nick Nurse said to me, you know, I was fully prepared. I was ready. I had my dukes up. And he said, the guy hasn't been one time that I've had to even look at him to worry about this. He's just been such an incredible leader. So,
well, his national team coach, Sergio, you know, he's actually Italian. I don't want to mangle his last name. Scarolio, I think, is how you pronounce it. I just call him Sergio. He's Italian, but he's been Spain's national team coach for a decade. And he's one of Nick's assistants. So I don't know how much that means, but he's got a guy on the coaching staff who, when he came to Toronto, he had a guy that he was really close to, that they had competed, you know, many, many summers, and they just won the World Cup, of course, this last summer Sergio as the head coach. And so, like, I don't know if that helps matters or whatever, or I also think that Mark has reached a point in his career where he understands he is going to play this role, and he's totally comfortable playing in that role, but it's been impressive. And you know, there's a couple of teams.
Well, and the fact that they won a championship last year probably gets them to relax a little bit.
Yeah, Marc Gasol had a pretty damn good 2019. He won the double ring, the gold medal and the diamond ring. That's, you don't see that happen. There's not many people who can say that. But there's a number of teams in the East. You know, we mentioned Milwaukee going along quietly. The Brooklyn Nets, now, their schedule has been favorable. And they're not exactly going through this schedule blowing teams out. Like, they just barely beat Cleveland on without Kevin Love on Monday night. But the Nets, without Kyrie, have crawled above 500. And I'm not going to entertain the idea that they might be better with Kyrie, but I will, without Kyrie, but I will say that what's basically happened here is they've sort of fallen back into the team that they were before Kyrie arrived. They've won 5 of 6. And again, Charlotte, Sacramento, Knicks, Cavs, Bulls. They lost to Indiana, the only kind of formidable team they played in there. And they're winning these games by 2 points, 1 point, you know, they're not exactly blowing teams out. But Spencer Dinwiddie, who was a revelation in Brooklyn, has been great. And Jared Allen, who I, you know, look, I understand why they had to take DeAndre Jordan. But I really thought that it was a problem that they were going to block Jared Allen's development because I thought he was a really good young player. Well, and I know this was just one game, okay, but DeAndre Jordan can't play on Monday, and what happens with Jared Allen when you give him real playing time? He goes for 20 and 20. And this is my whole thing with the Nets. The team that they were, the ethos that they had as an organization, the thing that impressed Kyrie and Kevin Durant enough to want to come there is naturally being suppressed by their presence. And I think this is a big thing for the Nets going forward. Can they have these stars do their thing, and the old Nets, Kenny Atkinson, we're going to outwork you, mm-hmm. still, I think that's a real thing for them going forward into the future and whether this can work with this roster.
Well, and the other thing that impressed those guys to get them to come to the Nets was geography and the fact that they weren't the Knicks. You know, and Jack, you wrote the story. The culture was great. I think any culture, though, looks great compared to the Knicks, and that's what got them the superstars. So the question is, can that culture continue or, you know, adapt in a form that is still good with those superstars there? And that's the whole story that you wrote, Jackie.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And it's been interesting, but here's why they're winning. They're playing defense. Look at their defensive numbers in the wins as opposed to the rest of the body of work. And again, we're talking about a small sample size. But, you know, so whenever we watch a game, it gets, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie drops 30, so that catches your eye for sure. But just look at the way they've been playing defense. And you know what? When they play defense like that and they get going like that, that favors a guy like Jared Allen. That's his DNA, right? That's what he's about. He's going to score especially if you're scoring off your defense. And that's been the difference in the five games. They're 4-1 since Kyrie went down, I think. I may be one game off on either side. But they've already started it in Brooklyn, just like they did here in Boston when Kyrie was out. Are we a better team without Kyrie Irving? The answer is they're a different team. And Kyrie is sitting and watching and has a chance now to figure out how he can come back and still operate within that team defensive system and still score and put up great numbers. I mean, he was putting up MVP-type numbers before he got hurt.
You know, Jackie, I wrote about the Celtics last week about whether or not this strategy that Brad Stevens is doing can work long-term. Mm-hmm. The way the Celtics are playing defense right now is like a symphony. It's like a symphony.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And I would have said that with Al Horford gone, your biggest problem was people were just going to go inside and pound you to death. And I looked it up just in case we talked about this today. Opponents' points in the paint, the Bucks are the stingiest with 39.3. The Celtics are, I don't know how, second at 41.3
points. I got a theory on that. And by the way, Al Horford and Aaron Baines gone. But yes. My theory on that is because it's so damn hard to get to the paint against them.
Yeah,
like you've got Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown, and you know these guys. Like it's hard; they don't let you go where you want to go. The challenge isn't how you do once you get there; it's getting there. Period.
I'll tell you what, though, Daniel Tice is playing. He's hurt. He was out. He didn't play last night with some kind of injury. But his defensive rating is 94.5. He's blocking shots. I didn't know he could block shots. To be honest, I mean, he's never played a significant amount. He's, you know, he's a guy that comes off the bench, an energy mm-hmm. guy, undersized, all of that. But he's been a much better shot blocker than I realized. He's a pretty good.
And Robert Williams has some potential as that kind of Capella-ish type of guy for sure.
He does. But the
problem is all three of their big men, Cantor, Robert Williams, and Tice, all have injury issues. They're always all hurt. But you know, you've heard of the phrase playing defense on a string. That's a very common phrase, the concept being that when one man moves, another man moves. Watching the Celtics defend right now, it's like watching a pinwheel.
The
story that I essentially wrote was, can this work? Can they beat the Sixers 4 out of 7 this way? Could they beat the Bucks 4 out of 7 this way?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being convinced more and more every time I watch him play, because basically what Brad Stevens has them doing is he's like, look, my best team is, and we mentioned the Bucks winning without Middleton and the Raptors winning without Serge and Kyle. The Celtics went 2-3 on their West Coast trip without Hayward, but they're hanging in there. What they do is they're constantly watching who each other is defending, and when there's a mismatch, whether it's Stevens from the bench or it's the players talking themselves, they find where the mismatch is and they fix it as fast as they can. They know, okay, this guy is on this guy. That's a problem. Let's do a quick switch. Let me help you. And the linchpin for the whole thing is Marcus Smart,
who there's no such thing as a mismatch for Marcus Smart. I mean, it's always in his favor. I'll put it that
like
way.
Like Embiid, it's hard.
I don't care how big.
Yeah,
like dude, Porzingis is not a good post-up player right now. But when it really fell apart for him in Boston when he had his worst game of the season, there were three quick trips in the third quarter where he tried to post up Marcus Smart, and Smart just took his lunch money every time until stop frustration offensive foul. He can give up a foot; and it's not a mismatch.
So I will tell you this though: I expect that from Marcus Smart because I've been watching it. What has impressed me the most is what Jason Tatum is doing on the defensive end. Now, I looked about 2 weeks ago because I was talking about him on something or another. But at the time, and these numbers may have shifted, when he was on the floor, teams were shooting 41%. When he stepped off the floor, they were shooting over 46%. He has been a really elite defender for them. And he doesn't get the credit that Marcus does because Marcus is, you can see it. It's much more tangible. But right. What you're talking about,
Jason doesn't guard guys who are bigger than him very often. He's usually the bigger guy. Whereas Marcus
is the other way around. He's got great length. But he and Jaylen Brown, it doesn't work unless they can do what they need to do. And they both are. And they both should. They deserve a lot of credit for it. They really do.
Well, in talking to Greg Popovich as things went sideways for the Team USA, he thought the loss of Jason Tatum when he turned his ankle and he missed the rest of the World Cup was the trigger point, because while Tatum isn't the type of dynamic player about some of those guys who'd elected not to play, he feels he's so important as a two-way player. He felt he was.
He really is. So, yeah, he's got a lot of potential. I mean, he's really, really talented. Although my friend Tim Bontemps and I argue about Jason Tatum quite a bit, actually.
I would argue about claiming Bontemps as your friend under any circumstances, but you do you.
Duly noted. Duly noted.
All right. Well, hope everybody has a good, safe Thanksgiving travel. Thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast. We've got a lot of big NBA action over the next few days. So in addition to listening to us, there's a lot to take in, and we will be back talking with you next week. Have a good holiday, everyone, and thank you for listening.